Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very pleased to have as my guest Douglas Stewart. He has written a first novel. The amazing thing about this first novel, which is called Shuggy Bane, is that it has been nominated for both the Booker Prize, it's on the short list of five, and for the American National Book Award. This is a very rare thing. His publisher, Grove Press, is very proud of him. And reading the book, I understood that pride. I was lost in admiration for this book. This book took me deeply into a world that I don't know. It's the story of a young boy, Shuggy, being raised in Scotland, in Glasgow, at the time of an enormous economic failure. The mines are closing. The steel mills are closing. People are living without money, without food. And Shuggy is living with his mother and his brother, Leek, short for Alexander. Shuggy is short for Hugh. And I've learned that Doogie is short for Douglas. So here we are in Scotland in the midst of poverty. To what extent is this book autobiographical? I know it is, but to what extent is it?
First of all, thanks for having me, Michael. But I think the book is largely autobiographical. I mean, I am the queer son of a single mother. I grew up on government benefits in Glasgow in the 1980s. You know, I came from a very proud working class family who sort of had the legs swept out from underneath them by some of the policies of the Thatcher government. And what that meant was, as my own mother sort of descended into alcoholism. I think I am the youngest of three children, and so even my earliest memories with my mother involve alcohol. It wasn't that she was necessarily drunk every day, but just alcohol was on the landscape of my childhood. We were always sort of watching for it coming round the bend. And then when I was 16, she actually succumbed to her addiction and she passed away. And so when I write about poverty, or I write about loving someone with addiction, or I write about being queer in a patriarchal society, I write about those feelings from the inside.
The book, in fact, is dedicated to your mother, and AED, I suppose, are her initials. What was her name?
Her actual name was Agnes Elizabeth Daly. And so I actually took the name of Agnes and made it the main character in the book as well. My mother has been dead for 30 years, and it wasn't that my mother was voiceless, or in fact that any of the women that I knew were voiceless, because by God, could these women roar. You know, they were very powerful, very forceful women. It was just when, I think when mothers are fallible, I think when women sort of fail in a way that we forgive men for, then society really doesn't like to look. And so some of the best thing I felt I could do with my trauma, you know, coming from like a post-industrial city from the west coast of Scotland, men aren't really meant to access their feelings. We're not encouraged to feel exceptional, exceptionally great, or exceptionally hard done to. And so to express ourselves isn't really something that we're encouraged to do either. And so being able to take some trauma and turn it into art was really the best thing I could do with it, I think.
Well, you really did turn it into art. I found the book, for me, as moving as I find another book that I absolutely love, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Although the book is called Shuggy Bane, that is the boy, but the main character is Agnes, and you've made her into a poor Elizabeth Taylor imitator. She dyes her hair when she's living among the people who are the wives of unemployed miners. She is so beautifully made up that they are ashamed of themselves in her company, and they love to ridicule her alcoholism because in every other way they're envious of her.
You know, I'm proud to be working class, and I've known the communities to be proud to be working class, but there was always such shame in absolute poverty that one of the ways that the women I grew up around would deal with it was, even when there was real hardship at home, they would never, ever, ever go across the front door without their best clothes on, without their hair done, without their faces sort of painted with makeup. And they just took that sort of, it was a rejection of shame, I think. Obviously, there's a lot of sort of pride there and a little bit of vanity, but it was such a coping mechanism that I wanted to sort of build a character around that. And that's what I wanted to do with the mother in the book. But what actually happens then is there's no solidarity for her. There's no sort of, even though the women on either side of her are exactly identical in terms of socioeconomic things, she is seen as such an outcast. She's really othered because she dares to be proud and she dares to sort of, to really turn her best face to the world every day, even though she is struggling in all the same ways that they are.
I'm so happy to have met her and read her and spent so much time with her. I'm afraid that, like Shaggy and like you, Douglas Stewart, I'd have been in love with her too.
I wanted to make her a character that people could fall in love with, and I wanted people to want to be in a room with her. You know, I think sometimes on the back of book jackets or when you see reviews in print, they describe her as the alcoholic mother. But of course, alcoholism is just the disease she's suffering with or the condition she's in. She, first of all, is a really sort of, I hope, a really fully rounded character and a really full woman. You know, she is generous, she's loving, she's tenacious, she's funny, she's exhausting, she is troubled, she's calamitous, she is very proud to the point of vanity. And she's all of these things before she is an alcoholic. And I just wanted to make sure that that I sort of captured that sort of both for her and also for the character of Shuggy.
You've left something out. She sparkles. She wears clothes that are covered with sequins, and she is dazzling. She dazzles. When she is more of an alcoholic, she uses her dazzle to find men who will buy her cans of alcohol. What is her favorite drink? It's not one I know. It's not one we have here in America. But tell me, because I could taste her drinks.
Oh, it's by a brand called Carlsberg, and it's called Special Brew. But essentially, it's a fortified lager, and Scotland is famous for having lots of fortified alcoholic beverages. The line in the book is they want a bus that will take them as far as possible for as little money as possible. And so it's a really fortified lager. It's quite severe stuff.
Shuggy Bain, he is her wee man. It's very moving and delightful to be reminded of the use of the word we. We don't use it. We would say little man or small man, but we man. And she has raised him to be conscious of how he looks. So he's always wearing unusual clothes and vests, looking like, what would you say?
A couple of times in the book, he looks like a Chicago gangster. You know, a little Al Capone. He has a sort of fish, a kipper tie on and a stripy shirt. But you're right in the fact that Agnes, I mean, even Agnes's rejection of the Glaswegian dialect, she speaks in a very standard Queen's English, you know, almost sort of projecting better airs and graces on herself. But it affects her son. It infects her son. And so he is seen as a little boy as his mother's greatest love, and he loves her as well, as being sort of effeminate and fey and precocious. And so the isolation that Agnes sort of gets from the other women also starts to sort of envelop Shuggy.
Now, was it true for you? Were you seen immediately as effeminate?
Yeah, I mean, Glasgow is an amazing and a beautiful city. It has lots of layers and lots of strata, but at the working class level, on the sort of the government housing schemes, it's a man's world. From the fact of we rely on a paycheck on a Friday, to the fact that it's a hard drinking and there's football all weekend, there's soccer all weekend. And, you know, we're raised as men to sort of like hit first and hit hardest, and, you know, and not being encouraged to express our emotions, you know, violence is often something that comes to the fore. Certainly as a sort of little effeminate introverted boy myself, I'm not even talking about the character, I was incredibly lonely. There was just no place in society for me. And when I talk to other writers and we talk about sort of like homophobia of the time, and it can be wrapped a lot in sort of religious ideals, it was never that in my upbringing or in Shuggy's sort of experience. It was really just about not being right. And the line in the book is, oh, that boy's no right. And it's just seen as, why would you want to be feminine? Why would you want to be effeminate? Because certainly women aren't very highly thought of at the time either.
I'm talking to Douglas Stewart. His first novel is Shuggy Bane, and it has just been published by Grove Press. I think it's an extraordinary novel. You know, I'm not much myself for realism, but Douglas Stewart made me fall in love with the world again. I was so moved, frequently to tears, while reading this book, not just by the character of the mother or the character of Shuggy, but the characters of their next-door neighbors and how desperate they are. Poor Shuggy has been given a little red pamphlet that contains football scores, and he thinks that if only he memorizes these football scores, he'll be thought of as normal. And he experiences, I think, a kind of love that does exist for a queer boy, the love from the mother.
Oh, definitely. And I think also love is the heart of the book. It is a love story. It covers a lot of subjects and a lot of themes, but at the heart of it is about the love between the mother and the son. And one of my favorite scenes in the book is his mother has her first date in the longest time with a new man that has come into her life. And she's asked Shuggy to teach her how to dance like the kids today do. And so he is dancing for her and showing her some moves, some mid-80s moves. And unbeknownst to him, the kids on the housing scheme outside are looking in their front window and they're mocking him. And Agnes realizes this, but she doesn't tell Shuggy, and she encourages him to keep dancing. And then when he realizes that they're mocking him, these kids are watching through the window, he freezes, and, you know, it brings him to tears, tears of shame. And she just says, you know, you've got to keep dancing no matter what it is. You know, just keep going. Don't let them see it hurts you. And she understands him deeply, I think, in that way. But she also understands what it is to sort of hold your head high and to reject shame and to push on through. And I think that's a really lovely sort of test of love.
Yes, she has chased her older two children away. One of them is now living in Africa. The other hasn't been able to wait until he can get to the south side of Glasgow and live independently. But Shuggy somehow knows that his mother's life depends on him, and he is willing to be the person who allows his mother to continue to live. It's a very extraordinary codependency, but I felt that these two characters were deeply in unavoidable love. What is the name of the girl that Shuggy meets who also has an alcoholic mother. What is her name?
Her name is Leanne.
And together, Leanne and Shaggy discover that they have lived a life, that they have much in common, that they are not, in fact, the outcasts each of them thought him or herself separately, that they have found, in fact, that the living with an alcoholic parent is yet another way of life, and it involves incredible acts of desperate kindness. And they are, when you meet them, they're not boyfriend and girlfriend, they are friends. She is Shaggy's friend. It's a deep friendship. It's a very moving friendship. And when you encounter that, you encounter the recognition that none of us are so strange that we are alone in the world.
One of the great joys of writing a book like Shaggy is not only to look at sort of working class lives and the what and the how, but also, you know, the way in which we should tell these stories, which is about collectiveness. It is about people sharing an experience at the same time. When you're growing up in a council house and your father's all work in the same place and everyone has the same sort of income and the same sort of housing and the same sort of experience, then at times, as a writer, you want to show sort of how it affects everybody. And it could have been a book that was very sort of focused on only Shaggy and Agnes, but I wanted to keep sort of zooming out and showing Shaggy with beautiful friendships with girls that were sort of going through very similar things. There's the character of Annie halfway through the book, and then there's the character of Leanne towards the end of the book. And it's in those moments that you sort of are reminded to yourself, Shaggy's going to be okay. It is really a lot about how far can you go to save the person you love the most before you have to save yourself. You're right about Shaggy and Agnes being codependent, but my favorite character in the book in a lot of ways is actually Leek, who is the middle child, because Leek is this very sort of sensitive, very quiet man. He is, in the book, we know him to be round about sort of 18 to 20 for most of the book. And he is a very sort of introverted, quiet. He's adopted like a very ghostly presence where he can kind of sort of vanish from situations. That's how he deals with trauma and what's sort of going around. But he furloughs all of his own dreams in order to sort of be there for Shaggy and support his younger brother and also for his mother. And I think that sort of like is a really radical, really powerful message of love and also a huge sacrifice that we make for the people who mean the most to us.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Douglas Stewart about his novel, Shaggy Bane. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Douglas Stewart about his novel Shaggy Bane, a powerful portrayal of a working-class family in 1980s Glasgow, and a son who sees the light in his deeply troubled mother. Leek can draw. Mm-hmm. He has notebooks of his pictures. He can draw his mother. He can draw Shaggy, he can draw almost anyone, but he doesn't have the funds that will take him to art school where he belongs. And so it's all based upon his loving what he discovers within himself. Similarly, Shaggy, who we meet at the beginning of the book, he's working in a supermarket in the deli section. And the women, he gets close to the cashiers. They're big women, they're extravagant women, and they like to take him to bingo with them. And he sits, and he loves watching them. He loves being surrounded by them. He's lost his mother by this time. The maternal is a huge facet of his life. They just want the experience of what a man feels like, even Shaggy. And they're beautiful to him because they're giving him an experience that he doesn't think he would otherwise have. He's frightened by it, to be sure. The men in his boarding house touch him in various ways, too.
I think this is what happens when people are made vulnerable by addiction, and they sort of don't have that sort of safety net to be able to sort of look after themselves. But I wanted to write Shaggy Bane from a sort of a queer and almost a woman's perspective, not a woman's perspective, but just to foreground women in this story in sort of the West of Scotland literature. You know, when you think about James Kelman or Alistair Gray, you know, there's a lot of sort of poor suffering souls, but they're always men. And when you think about post-industrial cities as being sort of male stories or being sort of storied by men, but I'd always grown up in a world of women. I probably spent my entire life looking for the company of women because I am looking for that maternal thing. I should tell my therapist that, but it's true. And so I just wanted it to almost be all the way through the book, just really to keep the lens on women and what the sort of the strength of mothers, the strength of sort of the community of women within this city. And that's really sort of, for me, the untold story of that city.
May I say this, a fantastic, absorbing book. It is not a surprise to me when I heard that it was nominated for both the National Book Award and the Booker Prize. It's so deeply written. Did writing the book make you cry?
Yes, it did. I cried many times in writing the book, and I felt like that was a really good thing for me. I found actually the writing of the book really cathartic, and I found if I didn't cry, then I didn't feel like I was telling the truth sometimes or being as honest as I could. But writing the book was great. I actually wrote the book, Michael, never knowing if it would be published. I don't come from a traditional MFA background. I don't come from a creative writing background. Growing up poor in Glasgow, to study English was not seen as something that boys like me should do. I come from a long line of manual laborers, slaters, hod carriers, joiners, shipbuilders. And so academia was like another world and just not seen for kids from our class, from my class. And so I actually began to write the book, and I wrote it in secret in a way. I actually, by trade, a textile designer, and that's what brought me to New York. I'm a knitter of all things, if you can believe that. It's a very Scottish thing to be. But I've started to write the book about 10 years ago, and I wrote it in secret, mostly because I wanted to write it for the pleasure of myself, and I had this that I wanted to express, but also because I was really cursed with an imposter syndrome and still carried a lot of sort of inferiority from my childhood and people not really believing that I could ever be capable of doing something like this. And so I wrote and I wrote and I wrote, and I didn't share it with anyone for 10 years, but I did a lot of crying in those 10 years to your question. And that was okay.
Yes, I did a lot of crying when reading the book, and it was more than okay. During this extraordinarily difficult time, it restored my heart and soul to the world and the difficult ways we find to cope in it. And I, you know, most of the time I'm looking for books that are more or less experimental in their form and rather extravagant in their invention. This is a realist novel in the great realist tradition, say, of Sister Carrie, of Theodore Dreiser. And, you know, I read it with my eyes wide open. It opened my eyes to everything around me during this devastating time. And I have heard, you tell me if this is true, Douglas, that you are now writing full time.
I am. I'm really excited. I mean, this is about a dream furloughed for me, Michael. And so it's taken me a long time. It's taken me most of my life to get to this point. I'm in my mid-40s now, but I'm working on my second novel at the moment. I was really lucky to have two stories in the New Yorker this year, but I just feel really fortunate to be where I'd always wanted to be. And I'm writing full time.
Well, I'm really thrilled for you. The book is filled with yearning and the achievement of telling difficult, not exactly secrets, but hard-held facets that make the book what it is, the narrator who he is, and the author who he is. I haven't read as deeply personal a book, I have to say it, in many years. And Douglas Stewart, you thrilled me with your novel, Shaggy Bane. Thank you for it.
Thank you. And thank you for having me on the show. It's such an honor for me, Michael. I would never have dared dream that I'd be talking to Michael Silverblatt. So thank you.
You think of Michael Silverblatt in a more venerated way than Michael Silverblatt does. And I suppose we are all that way. That is the thing. Our secret is shame. And we live to somehow conquer shame and move into the pride of who we really are. I've been talking with Douglas Stewart, author of Shaggy Bane, published by Grove Press. Douglas, when you finish your new book, I hope you'll join me again.
I would love that. I would be thrilled.
I want to tell my listeners that due to the pandemic, we are each taping from our respective residences, so you may hear unusual, unradio-like sounds. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. We even air twice a week in Berlin and, well, really all over the world. It can be also listened to on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Special thanks to my dear Bookworm Show collaborators, Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, engineer Paul Smith, and technical director Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Nicole Krauss is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.